I'm Jen Psaki. Welcome to The World Unpacked.
So Xinjiang is a western region of China that has a very high proportion of Turkic, mostly Muslim, ethnic minorities. That's been a long-term problem for the People's Republic because most of the residents of Xinjiang don't feel that they're Chinese.
James Palmer is a senior editor at Foreign Policy, the author of two books, and a former longtime resident of Beijing.
And many Han Chinese don't see them as properly Chinese, although they see the territory as belonging to China. That all started to get much worse about 10 years ago, after a series of riots in Urumqi, one of the major cities of Xinjiang, killed about 200 people and sparked a cycle of revenge killings, violence, and state crackdowns. Those crackdowns produced a huge divide between the Uyghur, who are the main ethnic minority in Xinjiang, the majority there, and the Han Chinese. Relations had never been good, but they descended to new lows. That caused huge government repression, which at first stayed within the normal bounds of sort of China's border states. But then violence started spilling out outside of Xinjiang, culminating in an attack by several Uyghur on a Chinese train station in Kunming in 2014. The attack was with knives, which are the normal weapon because there's very few guns available in China now. And it killed several dozen people, ordinary travelers, and caused a huge public outcry. Sort of the Chinese often compare it to 9/11. That resulted in prejudice against Uyghur throughout China, which had always been strong, intensifying. And Uyghur were pushed back from the rest of China into Xinjiang itself. So whereas once there was a very large internal diaspora, so there were, you know, 1 or 2 million at least Uyghur living outside of Xinjiang, working in factories or holding down, you know, ordinary office jobs or whatever, now there's almost none left. And those that are left are very closely monitored by the police. That influx of mostly young Uyghur back into Xinjiang, where there were no jobs or no jobs available for them, produced even more violence, even more anger against the Chinese population.
Among people living in the region.
Among people living in the region, among people who had just been sent back there from other cities. And that's produced the situation where we have now, where the Chinese government has begun a campaign of hugely intensified repression using both human labor and technological tools. The most notable feature of this has been the establishment of what are called re-education camps, which are a mixture of brainwashing programs and detention, into which roughly 1 million to 1.5 million Uyghur have been placed. There's also been a campaign of what many have described as cultural genocide against Uyghur culture and language. Most notably, the placing of Han Chinese in Uyghur homes in order to monitor them for what's called civilized behavior. And with that has come, for instance, the tearing down of the supa, the traditional Uyghur sort of stove bed, forcing people to eat pork, forcing people to participate in Chinese ritual life rather than Uyghur ritual life, both politically and religiously. And increasingly, we're seeing coerced labor. So people being forced into very low-paying or barely paying at all jobs for the Chinese state. Some of those people are coming out of the camps and being sent effectively to labor camps. Some of them are still living in their homes, but their jobs are now mandated by the state, and they're forced into textile work or cotton picking or whatever. Now, the Uyghur were actually a very successful business people. They had huge trade links with Central Asia. So the most notable Uyghur activists and thinkers were also business people. But all of that has been destroyed because, in particular, contacts with Central Asia are seen as very dangerous by the Chinese state.
And I wanted to just go back to one of the things you mentioned, which is the detention camps and the detention facilities. And there was a recent trove of documents that the New York Times published about, you know, government documents discussing how the detention facilities worked and giving instructions to bureaucrats on how to talk to students returning from college. Was there anything you learned from that, or what was your takeaway from looking at those documents?
So I think the most notable thing was how openly the role of the camps was acknowledged within the state. Mm-hmm. Like, this wasn't just a re-education program, as it was called, but it had this much bigger, more sweeping facility. And in particular, I think the details of the security of the wires, of the machine guns, of the emplacements, all this kind of thing were quite shocking. Mostly, I think those documents were very useful for making the case long-term that this is a crime against humanity. The more evidence we have directly from the Chinese state itself, even inadvertently, the better. China began by denying the existence of the camps at all, then went on to claim that they were re-education facilities in which people were being trained for skills and work, even though many of the people being detained were retirees or people who had existing businesses, were successful professionals or intellectuals and so on, and is now trying to portray this as an anti-terrorist measure, even though it, for many years, it didn't acknowledge that there was any violence or minimal violence in Xinjiang. So getting the actual record of the state itself down on paper is hugely important, especially when we're thinking, hopefully in the long term, about what kind of measures should be taken against the officials involved in this process.
So for people who haven't followed this as closely, people are Uyghurs and others living in Xinjiang were taken from their homes or businesses and put in these camps? Or how did it work exactly? And does it work?
So normally they were detained technically by the local police. They were herded into local stations, first of all, or held in temporary jails.
And from work or school, or where were they detained?
Like in the old Soviet Union, you know, you could be disappeared from any place at any point. Most of the cues for disappearance seem to have been contact with foreigners, contact with the wider Turkic world in particular, religious practice, family connections. We've seen that the Chinese are using AI techniques to supposedly identify threats. But what, of course, happens there is that, AI is not, in fact, intelligent. It responds to the biases and prejudices you feed into it. So as more people became arrested for, praying more often than was seen as normal, for instance, the more the system started to flag prayer as a risk in itself.
You know, one of the stories that's been told and in some of the recent reporting is students returning from college looking for family members and being told by government officials, a pack of information about where they were, warning them not to talk. How common was that, or is that?
So there's not that many students left, really. The most common thing, I think, has been people abroad calling and finding that there's no answer at home, having to call around relatives until eventually somebody is able to give them information about when their parents were taken, or when their brothers or sisters were taken. Everybody, I think, at this point knows of the existence of the camps. So there was a period when it was a shock in late 2017, early 2018. But now it's become a normalized part of the terror in Xinjiang. And people are very aware of the existence of the camps. They're very aware of how easy it is to be sent to them. They're very aware of how paranoid and nasty the system has become. And they take extreme measures to avoid being singled out. So I have one Western academic contact, for instance, who has studied long-term in Xinjiang, who, when she returned there last time, only two of her contacts would speak to her at all, and one of them insisted upon driving 10 or 20 miles outside of town, finding an isolated location, checking that there was nobody within eyesight before she would discuss the issue at all. And that level of fear, I think, is predominates, especially because the Chinese state goes out of its way not only to terrify family members into staying silent, but to attempting to terrorize the Uyghur community internationally. We've seen lots of evidence that they've been harassing and threatening members of the Uyghur diaspora in Australia, in here in Washington, D.C., where there's a big Uyghur population, and in Europe.
And when we come back, we're going to talk more about how the Chinese government is using technology and what Xinjiang means for Hong Kong. So we've talked in past episodes, actually, about how China is using internment to pilot new technologies, or the effort to intern and detain people. You talked about, you mentioned this a little bit, but walk us through a little bit. Where is the surveillance? How broad is it? You said, you mentioned they're tracking religion. What else are they looking for?
So within Xinjiang itself, the cities are plastered with cameras and checkpoints. And a lot of this is not technological so much as it is old-fashioned human labor. So we've seen that the numbers of security personnel employed within the region have gone up many, many times in the last few years. So a lot of this is just throwing, like, people at the problem. But that's combined with these centralized databases that attempt to record suspicious behavior. But that behavior is still being fed into the system by people on the ground, by local officials. There's also a lot of monitoring of cell phones in particular. Now, after the 2009 riots, the Chinese actually closed down the internet in Xinjiang for over a year. And that produced this phenomenon whereby a lot of Uyghur culture went offline or went to flash drives and digital copies and the exchange of material through still digital techniques, because you were, you know, plugging a flash drive into your computer or whatever. So they've for a while now conducted individual spot checks of phones on the street, pulled people over, installed programs that search for so-called suspicious material, such as Uyghur language documents or Turkic music, and installed monitoring software on cell phones in order to have a complete picture of what anybody is doing, what contacts they have. They've also been using network analysis to try and build pictures of Uyghur contacts, which of course produces this phenomenon whereby family, relatives, friends of somebody who falls under suspicion then become swept in, because the system starts to reinforce itself, because simply knowing somebody who's been arrested becomes cause for being arrested, which produces the illusion of some kind of network or cell, and fuels these kind of delusions on the part of the Chinese state. More than anything, I think what we're seeing is the interaction of political demand in the same way as the old Soviet Union, the demand for quotas, for numbers of arrests, to show activity with technology. And that technology isn't really allowing the repression. It's in some ways empowering it or taking existing biases and amplifying them on a vast scale. The most disturbing part of it, I think, is that we're seeing these facial recognition technologies attempted to be used to recognize Uyghur faces outside of Xinjiang itself, so to effectively spot Uyghur as soon as they arrive in another Chinese city or Chinese town, and then the police will basically go after them, check that they have permission to be there, put them under house arrest if not. Now, they were already doing that. They were already doing that just by human surveillance, just by people reporting Uyghur. So, for instance, there's a very assimilated upper-middle-class Uyghur woman I know of who traveled from one prosperous East Coast Chinese city where she was working to a coastal resort on holiday. And within a few hours of arriving in that resort, the police turned up at her door. She was staying with her infant son. and put her under house arrest for the entire week. Now, this was somebody who was whose entire existence is legal, who is very who has a job at a Chinese firm, who is has a college degree from a Chinese university, but simply her ethnicity was enough to cause this repression. And so the facial recognition, which we don't really know how well it's actually working, is just another part of this toolbox of essentially racist policing.
And another obvious major hotspot in China is Hong Kong, which you've also written about extensively. How do you see these two conflicts influence each other, or do they? Or what should the people watching Hong Kong kind of learn from what's been happening in Xinjiang?
So I don't think that there's that many direct parallels to be drawn, because obviously the situation is so different. For one thing, we've never had great eyes on Xinjiang. You know, our information there has always been very limited, even before these crackdowns, whereas Hong Kong is a world city. And the Chinese are very aware it's a world city, and that that severely limits the kind of measures that they can take. But Xinjiang has been a huge inspiration to the protesters in Hong Kong, particularly young people. They've often referenced it. They've often said Xinjiang is our future, somewhat exaggeratedly. Xinjiang is our future if we don't resist Beijing now. So Xinjiang acts as this kind of worst-case scenario for the Hong Kongers. And what I think is encouraging there is that in the long term, there needs to be some kind of reconciliation between Han and Uyghur. The two populations are still going to be living alongside each other, even if the situation gets better. Even if, you know, the Communist Party fell tomorrow, there would still be 10 million Uyghur living within China's borders, and a general popular reluctance against the idea of any kind of independence or separatism that's really drilled into the majority of Chinese. So the fact that Hong Kongers, who are part of this big amorphous group we call Han Chinese, are showing such solidarity with Uyghurs is really important in order to, in the long term, have some kind of reconciliation between the two communities, for Uyghurs to be able to point at Han, who stood up for them, who resisted this repression, is, I think, going to be really critical. And one of the things that was encouraging in the New York Times story was also seeing that some party officials had also attempted to resist these measures, had said, this is too far, this is too much.
You follow China closely, as we've been talking about, and you also read Chinese media. If you're an ordinary Chinese citizen, how much do you know about what's happening in Xinjiang?
Well, it's always very hard to tell, because there, as well as the official media, there are all these sort of rumor channels and mills and so on. I would say that the average Chinese person thinks that Uyghur are terrorists, thinks that they're backwards and uncivilized, and that China is a benevolent power trying to lift them up. So they see them somewhat as, say, a moderately conservative British person would have seen the Mau Mau in Kenya in the 1950s, or the rebels during the uprisings in India in the 1850s. They see them as basically ungrateful, and they believe that that China's measures are justified insofar as they know about China's measures at all. Now, of course, there are always people who are more aware of the truth, or who stumble into this understanding or empathy. I have Chinese friends who have left the country because of the knowledge of what's going on, especially since this has been coupled with much greater political repression across the whole of China for the last 5 or 6 years. And I've known young Chinese who have visited Tibet or Xinjiang in the past and come away with a complete sense of horror just from seeing the militarization of the province. I remember one girl saying, no wonder they hate us. But for most people, these are places that are very far away. I mean, Beijing to Urumqi is, you know, sort of London to Moscow type distance, and at even greater distance in many ways culturally, even though it's nominally part of the same country. Xinjiang is, I think, 3 hours time difference from Beijing, although China only officially acknowledges one time zone. And now, whereas in the past people kept their own local time, now keeping that local time has become politically suspicious. And so people are forced into this schedule that's several hours away from sort of the natural rhythms of the sun and so on. But that gives you some sense of how vast this distance is. And with Hong Kong, I'd say, even though there's much more contact with Hong Kong, mainlanders really dislike Hong Kongers. They really see them as being spoiled, as being ungrateful, as being corrupted by the West. There is a liberal streak of people who are very sympathetic to them, but that's now almost entirely silenced on the mainland, and so it's very hard to know how much it persists.
When we come back, we'll talk more about what this all means for China on the world stage. What consequences, if any, have the decisions made by the Chinese government in Xinjiang and Hong Kong had for Beijing on the world stage?
I think it's significantly hurt them. And the fact that there's been this very aggressive diplomatic response, that you now have Chinese ambassadors and other figures going on Twitter, going on other social media that are banned in China to really defend the Chinese record in a very childish way, insulting critics, calling things fake news, all these sort of Trumpian methods. That tells you that they're really quite disturbed by the damage that it's doing worldwide. And privately, the reaction from some Chinese government officials also seems to be a fear that this is hurting China's image, that this is unnecessary, that it's caused a swing against China. I think we see that most of all in the United States, but also in Australia and Canada and so on, that there's a really growing awareness of how unpleasant the Xi Jinping's rule has been. And Xinjiang has become this powerful image of it in the last few months. In a way, I think, though, Hong Kong was the trigger to start people really thinking about Xinjiang. Because of the Hong Kong protests, because there was this renewed focus on China, suddenly Xinjiang, which had been an issue for the camps had been an issue for, 2 years now, got all this renewed attention. And we've seen this rush of great coverage in the last sort of 3 or 4 months.
A number of China's closest partners, like Pakistan or Iran, are Muslim-majority countries. How does the internment of Muslims within China's borders impact those relationships, or does it?
Formally, it doesn't. China has, in fact, forced those countries to sign up to statements backing China's efforts in Xinjiang. At the political level, though, at the domestic political level, it's been causing real problems because it's become a way for the opposition in those countries to say to the leadership, which is, basically bowing to Beijing because they need the money, you're not real Muslims, you're betraying our brothers. And awareness of the issue in the Muslim world among the Muslim public has become very large. And we're seeing real criticism of China in places that were neutral or somewhat favorable to it before, like Indonesia, Malaysia, and so on, coming at the popular and the media level. So I think it is causing big problems. It's just that the governments don't feel confident in voicing that, in part because their own elites are so tied in with Beijing, and because their own elites often have a record of oppressing Muslims themselves. I mean, it's not as if China is the only country to arrest and persecute Muslims. It's just arresting and persecuting all Muslims, or at least all Uyghur Muslims, instead of a particular sect or denomination or whatever. One of the most interesting sets of relationships is with Kazakhstan and other Central Asian countries, where, again, officially the government doesn't really acknowledge anything, but unofficially, because those governments have ethnically Kazakh or Uzbek or Kyrgyz citizens in Xinjiang who have been sent to the camps, they did a lot of diplomacy to try and get them out. And so, in fact, we've seen many more releases of ethnic Kazakhs, for instance, than of the Uyghur. But at the same time, those governments have increasingly cracked down on organizations, human rights organizations, that seek to raise the Xinjiang issue because they're really afraid of disrupting this flow of capital from China.
And obviously China is quite powerful in the world on many fronts, as we've been discussing. What influence does the international community have? Are there levers that aren't being used that would be impactful in changing the course of events here?
I think the most fruitful technique would be to go after the division over Xi's crackdown as a whole among the Chinese elite. So many members of both the political and the financial elite in China see Xi Jinping as having made serious mistakes. I think portraying Xinjiang as one of those mistakes and having it cause real costs for that elite class would be very effective. And one of the main ways to do that is to go after, is to use Magnitsky-type tools, which we've already seen a little bit of, to go after the connections and ability of those families to spend their money in the West. One of the things that the Chinese elite values more than anything else is being able to educate their kids in Western universities, being able to spend their money freely in the West without fears, without the same fears of sort of anti-corruption measures and so on. And the more you can do to cut off that kind of access, the more upset they'll be and the more pressure that they might place internally. Now, the problem is that that will also spark a much fiercer reaction from China. We've already seen that with the Huawei case, where the arrest of the Huawei's chief financial officer in Canada really touched upon the sore spot of that kind of super elite class, of their ability to have, you know, $4 million houses in Vancouver and so on, felt threatened. And that was why one of the reasons why the Chinese reaction was so extreme. But in turn, that also helps make the Chinese public aware of how vast these discrepancies are and just how corrupt their own leadership remains even after supposed crackdowns.
James Palmer, thank you. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. It's been a fascinating conversation, and hopefully we'll have you back on the show again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The World Unpacked, which is produced by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information and to subscribe, you can find us at worldunpacked.com. Don't forget to rate the show. It helps other people find us. Our audio engineer is Tim Martin, and our executive producer is Lauren Duick.